You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence. And they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may have actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody, welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and today, today I'm going to talk a little bit about something that's been on my mind quite a bit. It's a topic that part of it, I had never even heard of it before. Even though I worked in addiction recovery, even though I have suffered from opioid use disorder on and off since I was 16 years old, I had never heard of the physiological effects of long-term sobriety. The term is post-acute withdrawal syndrome, or PAWS, P-A-W-S. We all know, especially those of us who have had an opioid use disorder, an addiction to heroin, fentanyl, OxyContin, you know, any opioid, morphine, we are all aware and you know, in pop culture, everybody knows the acute withdrawal from heroin, from opioids. This is the reason that you're stuck in the insanity in the first place. When you start using opioids and your body quickly grows accustomed to having that, you build up a tolerance very fast. You need more of the drug to achieve the desired effect, though that true desired effect diminishes. You'll never feel it again. And you're constantly, you know, your mind, even if it's subconsciously, you're constantly chasing that, the way that it made you feel the very first time that you used an opioid. And I described it, the first time that I ever was introduced to it was by innocent means, 15-year-old clean-cut athlete that was injured on the football field, rushed to the emergency room and was given a shot of morphine right into my vein through an IV. And the feeling that overcame me I went from the worst excruciating pain that I'd ever felt to the most euphoric, comforting, warming, celestial, heavenly feeling that you could ever feel. And it wasn't just the feeling, it was the sensation that whatever had been missing in my life, whatever had been, I had been lacking throughout my life. And a lot of that probably has to do with teenager angst and the hormone changes and all that. But anything that was ever lacking, any insecurities, any lack of connection, anything, it felt like that was what I had been missing my entire life. Like, even though I was not missing anything, even though I had everything I needed, you know what I'm talking about. That sensation that, okay, that I want to feel this way for every moment the rest of my life. That's how great it felt. And I was not an addict. I had never used opioid drugs. I had never, I was totally against partying and doing drugs and drinking alcohol and all of that. So why did it make me feel that way, right? You start an addiction. I don't care how you started. That's irrelevant to me. You know, we're always stuck in society about the debate between, well, is addiction a choice or is it a disease? Is it a moral failing? Is it, that's just a wrong debate to have, because regardless of what it is, which clearly, if you believe in science and medical advancements the neurosurgeons and the experts, addiction is clearly defined as a brain disorder, a brain disease. It's not a symptom of some sort of moral failing, or you're a bad person, you don't care about other people. Science has proven that, but I just don't even engage in that debate anymore, because it's just, for one, it doesn't matter, because there's so many of us that are suffering, that are afflicted and sick and dying, that who cares, right? You have COVID-19 and you're in the hospital and you're about to go on a ventilator. Do they say, well, how did you get this? Did you go out to a major party and not wear a mask? Did you go? No, they don't. It's irrelevant, because the task at hand is saving the person's life. You can, there's always time later to educate them or, teach them how to follow simple health guidelines, public safety, public health guidelines, so you minimize your chances of contracting the disease. But it's irrelevant, and so I don't engage in that debate. For one, it's a lot of backwards, closed-minded people that deny science in many facets of life. So of course they're going to deny medical fact and science, with addiction. It's just, so I don't engage in that debate, but I'm kind of getting off in a tangent there. We all know, right? We've seen the movies. We've seen, if you probably have a loved one, a child, a parent that is suffering from an opioid use disorder, and they seem like they're constantly sick, right? They're just always withdrawing. We know about that. That is very well documented. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that first to set up what I really want to talk about. So acute withdrawal is that moment, sometimes 12 to 24 hours after your last dose of an opioid drug, your body goes into withdrawal. And it is, I've never truly been able to describe it in a way that does it justice, because it's not just the outward signs, you know, the we all know the some of the symptoms. I'm going to read off this because I just don't want to leave any out, but I don't need to read it. I've gone through it for more than half my life. But the symptoms include anxiety, crippling anxiety, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, pain in the muscles, like body aches. Your whole body just hurts, like every muscle, every bone, every nerve just hurts, You're just in pain. And diarrhea. So there's gastrointestinal things are really severe, because yes, they say that you cannot die from purely from opioid withdrawal. Symptoms can be severe, but they aren't life threatening. And I would argue against that, because when you have this level of sickness, when you're constantly vomiting, you're constantly nauseated, you're constantly have diarrhea, and it's really not diarrhea. I don't want to get too graphic, but it is liquid, you know, and I'll leave it at that. So you are shedding all water retention. You know, you could be very well hydrated, which most opioid users are not ever well hydrated. So the dehydration is what is life threatening. So the gastrointestinal obviously is the diarrhea, vomiting, and nausea. But there's another symptom that affects me greatly, and I really don't hear it talked about too much, but it's like the GERD, heartburn, but it's not really like heartburn. It's just indigestion. That's, like just an acidy, gunk in your gut that just constantly comes up, and you dry heave because you don't eat. You don't want to eat. You don't want to drink anything. You're just in very bad, flu-like symptoms, COVID-like symptoms. You know, you hear all these harrowing stories about people who have COVID-19 really, really bad, you know, not the pneumonia part of it, but just the fever chills, the teeth shattering, cold chills, cold sweats, hot flashes, fever dreams. You know, you're sweating bullets, literally dripping with sweat, but you're cold as ice. And then you bundle up, and then you know this heat wave comes over you, and you're burning up. You're just constant. It's just a constant. It's pure hell. It is pure hell. If I died and went to hell, my eternity of torment would be perpetual withdrawal from opioids. You are restless. You cannot sleep. You can't sit still. You're trying to lay down and go to sleep, but you can't. So then the insomnia starts, you know, just that feeling of not having any sleep for days, you know that feeling. General discontent. I mentioned anxiety. It's just more than anxiety, though. It's an overwhelming, crippling thing. Your eyes are constantly watering. Your abdominal area is cramping. Your heart rate is very fast. One of the more weird symptoms is excessive yawning. So you are yawning nonstop. You can't stop yawning, but you're not tired. You can't go to sleep. Goosebumps, that comes from the chills, and tremors. Tremors is a big one. Just involuntarily muscle spasms, tremors, you just shake. You know, I had a friend who has COVID-19 right now, who was describing to me that he was so sick that he was trying to write an email, a two paragraph email, and he just couldn't sit at his computer and type that email. He was just so exhausted and just weak. You know, it's just this feeling of just, man, I can't move. I can't even do the simple things like brushing my teeth. I can't. Not that I don't want to, but I can't, I don't have the strength. That's what it's like. And so, and not only that, but your brain, the chemicals in your brain are so out of whack that the neurotransmitters, the messages that's getting sent to your nervous system, you know, that part of the brain that tells you to breathe, that tells you you need to eat, that when you get shot at without thinking about it, you hit the ground and dive for cover, that instinctive part of the brain, that mammalian midbrain, I've talked a little bit about it before. It's not in the frontal cortex part of your brain where you're making decisions like between right and wrong, or what book you want to read or what food you want to eat. That's not where addiction is, and that's where most of society thinks that it's in. So it's like, well, why don't you just, you know, stop? What are you doing? But it's a very weird phenomenon that's indescribable. The fear of that intense withdrawal drives that compulsion to, you know, and so I look at it like this, or I describe it like this. You have the worst sickness, the worst flu or COVID-19 case that you would ever imagine. You every day, okay, that's what is happening to you. And you know that all you need to do to cure that, and I'm not meaning just kind of feel better, I'm talking about instantly cure the worst sickness you can imagine in an instant. And that's by getting one more dose of heroin or fentanyl or morphine or oxycodone. It's going to cure you right away. Those of you who have been sick with a life-threatening illness, a flu-like illness, where you just want to die, you are so sick. If there was a pill or a dose of something that you could take, and within seconds you would go from that feeling of just despair and the worst sickness ever to being on cloud nine, having no pain, no sickness, no cares, just being completely content and heavenly feeling. That's what it is. That's what it's like. And that's why it's so difficult to break away from that. And that's why you need major intervention. That's why you need a major stabilization period. That's why you need to go away to detox medically so you can diminish some of those more severe symptoms of withdrawal. And so that you can stabilize yourself, your mind, the chemicals in your brain, get back in balance. The clarity comes back. You start to learn about recovery and, you know, you have several months or even years in sobriety. And then you start to begin to feel like you hit a wall inexplicably. I never knew what that was, but I learned. It's called post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Post meaning after, syndrome meaning a group of symptoms. So symptoms that occur after the acute withdrawal, after you're clean and sober, you know, months into long-term sobriety, these symptoms start. And what it is described as, it's results from the combination of the damage that those drugs have done to your nervous system caused by the drugs, and the psychosocial stress of coping with life without the drugs and alcohol. Life happens. You're no longer able to numb all those feelings and all those responsibilities. And so that stress comes in. Especially if you put on a lot of stress on yourself, thinking that, you know, being engaged in all these good things is going to help you not wanting to use drugs. So the most identifiable characteristic is the inability to solve usually simple problems. A person often feels incompetent, embarrassed, and not okay about themselves. Diminished self-esteem and fear of failure interfere with productive and challenging living. So some of the other symptoms that contribute to the inability to solve usually simple problems. Some of the symptoms are inability to think clearly all of a sudden. Memory problems out of the blue, emotional overreaction, sleep disturbances, physical coordination problems, stress sensitivity. These are all things that are emblematic of post-acute withdrawal syndrome. And since I learned about this, now I know how to guard against that, because I'm coming up on a year of sobriety, and I'm on the lookout for these symptoms that will probably occur, and I need to be aware of that and guard against it. Some of the things that I need to do in managing those symptoms is continuing to be stabilized, right? To always not grow complacent, to realize that I am still in this fight. It's a daily fight. Some of the things that I like that are very eye-opening to me is part of managing these symptoms of pause is verbalization and ventilation. Verbalization is you start to, you talk to people who are not going to accuse, criticize, or minimize what is happening. In my case, I'm blessed to be able to do that with my wife and with some close confidants, that I have, in recovery that are not, you know, I can bring up these issues. I can talk about them. So I verbalize them. Another way that I do that is through this podcast. I verbalize things and I'm able to get my thoughts out and think about them. So that helps me look at my situation more realistically. And ventilation is express as much as you can about what you are thinking and feeling, even if it seems irrational or unfounded. You have to get those thoughts out in the open to somebody that can say, I think you're being irrational about that, or yeah, that doesn't really make sense. You know, and then you can talk about those things. So you're not just stuck in your head. You're not just withdrawing and isolating to where, you know, you just don't want to talk to anybody about anything. You end up thinking irrationally. You end up exhibiting symptoms of relapse behavior, and then you're down a wrong path. And sometimes it's hard to even recognize that. And then before you know it, you've relapsed and you wonder what happened. Reality testing. This is something that I do all the time. I ask someone that I trust if I'm making sense. And I'm not talking about you internet trolls who tell me that I'm out of my mind, and I've sold out, or, you know, I've whatever. I don't listen to you. I listen to people that I trust and that I care about and I know that care about me. And they will tell me if what I'm saying and what I'm doing, the goals that I'm setting, the plans that I'm making, my perception of what is going on around me, my perception of myself, my, you know, everything. I test that with people. And then when they can say, well, you know, I think your thinking is flawed about this or that. I think you, you don't have all the facts, or let's talk this through. You know, if you're just stuck in your own mind, you're so self-absorbed that you don't, you know, talk out loud and get your thoughts out loud, you could end up being very irrational, and irrationality leads to a failure to meet expectations that you set for yourself and that others set for you. Failing to meet expectations is a very big trigger for me in my relapses in the past. And so a big part of that is when I set expectations is to talk that out with people so that I know that I'm setting realistic expectations and goals and plans and things about what I'm doing. Some other things that you need to do every day in long-term recovery, long-term sobriety, is education and retraining. You can't get to that point where you think, oh, I know everything there is to know about addiction. I've battled this my whole life. There's nothing more anybody can teach me. There's nothing more that I could hear. There's nothing more that I need to know. That's flawed, because you're always evolving. Things are always evolving. Best practices are always advancing. And so you always want to stay on top of that and to educate yourself. Self-protective behavior is, you know, you're responsible for protecting yourself from anything that threatens your sobriety. And I don't know who needs to hear this, but if you are an opioid addict, and that's the only drug you've ever, struggled with, and you are abstinent from that, and you start to begin to think that, well, I can drink socially because I've never had a problem with alcohol. That is not self-protective behavior. That is flawed logic, because at the end of the day, that alcohol is still serving a need for you. And it's just a matter of time before you go to what your addiction really wants and needs. And that's opioids. And that's just, I've seen it countless times in my life, not with myself, because I've never been a drinker, but with friends, close friends that are hardcore heroin addicts. They are clean and sober from that. They're abstinent from it. They're in solid ground in recovery. And then they begin to drink a beer or two. And then they begin to go out on the weekends and drink at the bars. And then they go, and then it progresses. And then before you know it, they have a needle in their arm again, using heroin. And they are always dumbfounded as to why and how that could have happened. You have to abstain from any of those mind-altering, mood-altering substances. You just have to. And if you're not willing to do that, then it might work for you. But if it does, you're a very small percentage of people that actually works for. A big one is nutrition. And I am the worst at that. I constantly am eating chips, constantly drinking soda or Red Bull. I don't have great sleep habits. I don't drink water enough. All of this stuff, it works so much together. Everything, it's a holistic view you have to have of your whole body, your whole soul. And nutrition is a major part of that. And in addiction recovery now, in treatment centers, that it plays a major role. Eating 3 healthy meals a day, drinking the enough water, getting enough sleep, exercising. I have been very good since coming home from rehab almost a year ago with exercising. And I've gotten back into basketball, which has always been a major love of mine since I was 5 years old that I had completely abandoned years ago. And I'm starting to get back into that. I play in a little pickup group that we play every week for a few hours late, at night. And that's been great. It's been so great to get out there and run and play ball again. I put in a hoop, a great basketball hoop at my house to enjoy that, to teach my son and daughter the game. And I'm out there every day shooting baskets like I did when I was in high school. It's very comforting and therapeutic for me. But my wife is always on me. I always feel guilty about it, but I do not eat healthy. I do not drink healthy things. And that's something that I just procrastinate about it. I know that I need to cut out the energy drinks. I know that I need to cut out the soda. I know that I need to drink water. And I know that I need to eat healthy meals and not just hot Cheeto fries and white cheddar popcorn. That's my go-to with Red Bull. If the camera angle was down, you would see the bags, chips, and the drink and the energy drink. That's a very bad habit and something that I need to stop doing. Relaxation and spirituality. These are major important things to guard against post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Spirituality, some people, don't really know what that means. Does that mean, I'm going to go to church every Sunday, I'm going to be religious? No, not necessarily. Spirituality and religion really are of course, they're closely related, but they are not mutually exclusive. Spirituality can be defined as an active relationship with a power greater than yourself that gives your life meaning and purpose. In the United States and in the Western world, the dominant religion is Christianity. And so it's inevitable that in the 12-step communities, God, as we as Christians know him, the Savior, Jesus Christ, that's my higher power. And I don't shy away from that. But your higher power, your spirituality can be your own. Religion often in the culture that goes into it, the church goers, the can be some of the worst judgmental people in the world. And so sometimes that's harmful for people that struggle with addiction to go to church and know that people are looking at them differently, that people are judging them, people are horrible in what they say behind your back and online. That's not what's important. What's important is your personal relationship with a higher power. that will and being a part of something that's meaningful and gives your life purpose. That is what's important. And for me, that is everything. Because whenever I neglect that relationship with my Savior, Jesus Christ, my spirituality tanks, my complacency skyrockets, my pride comes in, feeling like there's nothing more I need to learn. I got this. This battle is over. I won it. And I can abandon everything that I had been doing that's gotten me the success and where I am in sobriety. It always goes hand in hand. And so I know that that is something that I need to nurture and grow, just like if it was a person like my wife, our relationship, my relationship with God. I have to put in the same commitment and work, praying, meditating, being grateful for what I have, counting my blessings, trying to see the good in every situation and not focus on the horrible, bad things, being optimistic. All of that stuff brings peace and serenity through the grace of my Savior. But that, if you're Muslim, if you're Buddhist, if you're atheist, you can have a higher power and have spirituality that brings you meaning and purpose and serenity in your life. Trying to go down the path of sobriety and recovery without that, I've never known anybody to be able to do that. Just put it that way. So it's very important. The last one that I'll talk about here is balanced living. Balanced living, it means your bio, psycho, and social and spiritual harmony. You have that harmony in your life. It means that you are healthy physically and psychologically, that you have healthy relationships. It means that you are spiritually whole, that you feel healing and forgiveness for the things, the bad things that you've done, your shortcomings, your weaknesses. You know, it's the 12 steps. Work the 12 steps and get the help you need psychologically, emotionally, spiritually. Have that balance in your life. It means that you're no longer focused on one aspect of your life. You live responsibly. You give yourself time for your job, your family, your work life, time for your own growth and recovery. You engage in service to other people, but you're not consumed by it because you have to take care of yourself as well. This balance is another. This imbalance, I guess, with all of this is another major reason that I relapsed after years in sobriety because I was imbalanced. I had too much on my plate, though they were all great things and good causes and service and all of that. I neglected that balance that I needed to be healthy in every sense of that word. And so that's something that I always have to keep in front of me. To know and understand that I have to live balanced. I have to have a good balance of everything. Family, professional life, politics for me, sports, therapy, church service. All of these things need to be moderated and balanced. And it helps you maintain a level of stress that's optimum, right? Humans are geared and engineered to have stress. Stress is good when it's optimal, when it's optimized, when it's there. You have a deadline at work, you have these things that it keeps us productive and it keeps us going and keeps us healthy and keeps, we have a purpose to achieve, an objective, a mission. But when you have too much stress, it can be fatal. So, you have to maintain that level of stress that keeps you functioning in a healthy way when not overloading yourself. When you do that, you become counterproductive. With a balanced living, it also means that you delay immediate gratification. That was your addiction. That's all it's about, right? Immediate gratification. You learn to delay that, and that's the lifestyle that you choose, in order to attain a more fulfilling and meaningful life. Balanced living needs strong social networks that nurtures you and encourages a healthy recovery-oriented lifestyle. A healthy network provides a sense of belonging and includes relationships in which you feel you are a valuable part. It includes immediate family members, friends, relatives, coworkers, counselors, employers, self-help group members, and sponsors. My circle is small, but I trust my circle, and I'm able to talk to them, and I'm able to feel a part of something, be a valuable part of a relationship, and I'm able to bounce things off of them, and I'm able to mentor them, and they're mentor me. All of these things are healthy, and you need it. Guard against post-acute withdrawal syndrome. I encourage you to research it more. But it's for those of us who have dealt with opioid addiction. I know that you, when I'm talking about this stuff, even though you've never may have never heard of that term, you know that you've experienced it. And it usually comes after you achieve some meaningful long-term sobriety and recovery, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 7 months, 8 months, 9 months, 10 months, whatever. It can happen whenever. And some of those symptoms you need to be aware of, and guard against them. And those things that I mentioned will help you in that. It's helped me. And I just want to pass this knowledge along. Thank you for listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. We will be back next episode. You won't want to miss it. Thank you again for listening, for watching. You make what I do fun and enjoyable and meaningful. And thank you for the feedback. The podcast that I put out with my episode with my wife, we received such great messages, most of them private messages from people that are dealing with the same thing. They don't want to put it out publicly, but they were very thankful and grateful to be able to see the things that have helped us in our life, in our struggle, in our battle. And we wish to do that more because of the amazing feedback we've had. Hopefully we can do an episode together every month. That's what we're shooting for. Because it was great for us as well. It's very therapeutic for us to do as well. So thank you. Have a great, great weekend. I'm looking forward to the fights this weekend. The first big pay-per-view fight of the year, Conor McGregor and Dustin Poirier. I love Dustin Poirier. He's one of my favorite fighters. He's just a great human being. I've always loved Conor McGregor though too. I'm happy with the growth, personal growth that is clear in his life, in his path. He's a responsible father now. Seems to be a responsible, loving husband. Now he's not, he's more grounded. It's hard not to root for him. The fact that the fight is going to be on Saturday, the 23rd, is the 2 year anniversary of when my sweet baby Connor, passed away. And so, as much as I love Dustin Poirier, I see that as a sign to root and back Connor McGregor. If I was a gambler, I'd put money on him. Maybe if anybody wants to do a small $20 bet, hit me up. I got Conor McGregor winning by knockout, in the second or third round. So anyway, have a great one. Thank you all for listening.